Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I was trying to figure out whether I'm in a good mood or a bad mood this morning. I don't know. I mean, it's springtime. The blossoms are out in Wisconsin. We had this gorgeous blossoming tree out front in our house, and it blossoms for about 2 or 3 days a year. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. And almost always what happens is it just explodes with this wonderful pink color, and then it rains the next day, and we have these blossoms everywhere. So it is spring. Things are going well. On the other hand, you wake up to the usual. I'm sorry, bullshit. Kevin McCarthy all in on purging Liz Cheney. This is one of those where it feels like we're living in a cartoon version of a caricature. The Facebook Oversight Committee came down with its ruling. It is not going to restore Donald Trump to Facebook. That's one thing. But it also essentially throws the ball back to Facebook, saying, "Hey guys, you wanted us to take over the responsibility. This is your responsibility. You got to do your job. You have to come up with some sort of a standard." So, what's interesting about that, of course, is that the Trump folks apparently took this decision very, very seriously. They really, really want to get back on Facebook. You may have seen that Fox News breathlessly reported that Donald Trump has launched his own social media platform, which they describe as a place where he can, you know, allow followers, you know, to share the president's post to Twitter and Facebook, but it doesn't have any feature to allow users to reply or to engage with Trump in any way. So it's just a one-way communication, which is known as a blog. So the president has a blog that appears to be very heavily focused on raising money. What a surprise. How amazing. So on our podcast today, we welcome back Robert Trzesinski, a contributor to The Bulwark, who just had a great piece about liberalism, illiberalism, and Sohrab Ahmari. So, Robert, welcome back to the podcast.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Did you see the way I described Sohrab Ahmari the other day? Now, I'll repeat like this. This is kind of inside baseball, I suppose, because most people don't follow this. But he is the editorial page editor of the New York Post. And mm-hmm. I said that if there was actually a church of bad faith argumentation, Sohrab would be a cardinal.
Yeah, I did see that. And it really is the case that I feel almost regretful every time I engage with him. I mean, he's got a prominent platform. He's having a lot of influence on the direction of the conservative movement for the worse. And so I feel like you have to respond to him. But it's a lot like dealing with an internet troll or somebody on Twitter, you know, where you almost feel like you're giving him oxygen and you know you're not going to get an honest response on a lot of stuff. You know, the other reason I feel bad about engaging with him is, you know, given his history, I sort of feel like if I disagree with what he says, all I have to do is wait a couple of years and it'll all change.
Right. He's gone from like secular Muslim to atheist to card carrying communist to blah, 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 blah.
Well, he was a pretty straightforward sort of neoconservative, somebody who's been passing around in 2017, which is not that long ago, him writing a piece about the alarming spread of illiberalism in Commentary magazine. And, you know, so he's basically warning us about him, you know, 4 years ago, and now he has gone completely to the opposite side. So he's kind of an ideological chameleon type, and which a lot of people have turned out to be, unfortunately.
Well, it is entertaining to watch, you know, where the arc of Sohrab Ahmari is headed. It's not towards freedom, obviously, but he went from, as you point out, neoconservative. Now he is, you know, I don't know what he would say, sort of fascist adjacent or curious, rejecting illiberalism. And the latest iteration is that he admires the Chi-Coms. He says, "I'm totally at peace with China dominating the next century because I don't know because did I get this right? Because they would protect religious liberty better than our pagan society." And that's where you go. No, how much time do you want to devote to, you know, understanding what the hell he's talking about?
Yeah, I think that you have to view him as like a mirror image of the left, and the idea that there's a lot of people on the left. I think somebody called it oikophobia, which is, you know, fear of your own or hate, fear or hatred of the society from which you come. And so there's a lot of people on the left who anything associated with America or the West is bad. And he is sort of like the mirror image of that from the right, where anything associated with America is bad, and anything that's against America, therefore, must be good. And the Chinese are rivals. And I guess he imagines them to be more traditionalist. I don't really think that's true, but I think he has this imagination that, oh, they have this deep Confucian foundation, which is, you know, it's very typical thing that Americans do of looking at a foreign society of which we don't understand very well from this distance in this rosy colored way and projecting our own sort of wishes onto it. And I think that's what he's doing there.
Now, I imagine this is in, go ahead.
As I said, but it is really, it's like anything that's not America, not modern liberalism, must be therefore be good. And it's pretty indiscriminate.
Yeah. Well, see, this is what must be confusing for people who go, wait. I thought the New York Post and Rupert Murdoch's, you know, tabloid and people like Sora Bamari, that this was the new right wing. And so it is confusing because it sort of goes, you know, the line goes, you know, we are America first. We are the real patriots. We love our country, which is terrible and pagan. And we need to be really strong against the evil Chinese who are actually probably better than we are because we are pagan and God. I mean, it's like this, whoa, what's going on there? How are the synapses firing in this guy's head? I just don't know. But it is interesting. It is sort of a brave new look for the America First patriots to basically go, yes, our country is so corrupt and so pagan that I prefer the Chi-Coms. I mean,
well, you know, I look at Amari, I sort of look at him as Donald Trump writ small. Which is, you know, it's all the same contradictions that we see, this sort of lack of intellectual coherence, the emotion, the style of it is very emotional. It's like, I have feelings about things and I'm not, so intellectual coherence is not very strong. It's really trolling and appealing to resentment and all of that. And, you know, and the idea of this leadership by somebody who is, you know, ideologically either vacant or fickle, and also, you know, does not postures a lot about the importance of religion and morality while being not exactly a good exemplar of moral virtue.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's all about, you know, having the right posture, having the right enemies, throwing out the right insults. So speaking of intellectual incoherence, so that seems like a perfect segue to talk about Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans in the House of Representatives who are all in it. I mean, as we wake up this morning, we're getting the reports that the leadership of the House Republican Party is all in getting rid of Liz Cheney for the sin of speaking the truth about the 2020 election. They're making phone calls. There will be a vote next week. It seems almost certain that Liz Cheney will be thrown out. She will be replaced by Elise Stefanik, who has been one of those figures, fascinating figures, who has morphed from being a reasonable moderate into a complete Trumpian troll. So let's start with this, though. So Kevin McCarthy had supported her earlier in the year. I mean, you know, as part of his changing, morphing, chameleon-like tofu quality, he went from being willing to call out Donald Trump to going down to Mar-a-Lago on bended knee and kissing the orange one's posterior. And now he's
going to go with ring, Charlie, kissing the ring.
Yeah, I was going to go with ring, and I thought, you know, it's a podcast, and I'm actually not thinking ring, so I might as well, you know, that's what we do. We say what we think. So he's now anti, he's sort of edged to anti Liz Cheney. Well, he was caught on mic. I don't know how the quality of this audio is very good, but he's preparing to go on one of the Fox News shows where he throws her under the bus. But makes it very, very clear that he's just done with her. So let's just play this. This is a hot mic. Mike McCarthy did not mean this to go out over the air, but this is what he's saying before the cameras went on at Fox News.
I think she's got real problems. I've had it with. It's, you know, I've lost confidence. Well, someone just has to bring emotion, but I assume that will probably take place.
Yeah, I've lost confidence. She's got real problems. You know, somebody has to make the motion, but I assume that that's going to happen. So, Robert, let's just talk about this, because what's really extraordinary is that the Republicans are quite explicitly now making the the big lie a litmus test, or at least mm-hmm. not calling the lie out, a litmus test for survival. And as of the end of next week, the literally the only person who the Republicans will sanction for their role in the insurrection or around the insurrection will be Liz Cheney, because she continued to refuse to whitewash it and tell the truth. And she's going to be punished for that. That's a hell of a look for the Republicans in Congress, isn't it?
Well, and this follows that meeting in Utah where they were booing Mitt Romney. The Republicans are in kind of a doom spiral. Now, you know, I kind of feel sheepish about criticizing politicians for not having moral courage, because that's not the job description, right? The job description is there go the people, I must follow them, for I am their leader. Politicians are going to respond to what they see as the mood of the electorate. But what the doom spiral here that the Republicans are in is they're not really responding to the mood of the electorate. The mood of the electorate is not, you know, as the general public and independent voters, that's not where the mood of the electorate is. They're in this doom spiral where they're actually reacting to the mood of a very narrow base and a narrower base of the Republican Party, as filtered through one guy who is the sort of celebrity leader. And this is, you know, the whole celebrity reality TV politics that we have now. That's how it kind of wrecks a party, is that everything gets filtered through one guy and his mood this morning and what he said today on his app that is totally not Twitter, even though it exists only to allow you to repost things on Twitter.
So this is what I don't understand at this point. Is this just inside baseball? Because normally, you know, internal caucus fights over the House conference chairman doesn't really register with anybody outside of Washington. In fact, I think it would be a safe bet to think that 95% of Americans never have heard of the House conference chairman or whatever that is. So does this actually make a difference? Is it a doom spiral, or is this just internal housekeeping that won't have any effect on the 2020 midterms?
Well, how much effect it has on the average voter is one question. But I think it has an effect on the party. It's sort of an inside baseball internal party thing. But what it means is it's a message to anybody who is a Republican who's thinking of running, anybody who's in Congress, this is what happens to you if you cross this line. Yeah. So I think the significance is it's one of these internal things, but it's helping to, I think you put it really well, create the big lie as a litmus test, the big lie being the stolen election conspiracy theory. It creates that as a litmus test, and it creates loyalty to Trump as a litmus, as a litmus test. And so that's the effect that it has. And I think if it impacts the 2020 midterms, it might be in the other direction, which is, you know, making it harder for them to find and recruit and promote candidates that, you know, independent voters would actually want to vote for.
What was interesting is that the way McCarthy is spinning this, he's saying that it's not because of her vote on impeachment. We're past that. It's that she won't stop talking about it. And this seems to be the new argument that this is happening because she will not shut up. It's kind of the version of the look what you're making us do.
Right,
it's kind of
right.
Like all the guys, the abusers, like this is, you know, if you weren't so mouthy, this wouldn't be happening. Look what you're making us do to you. And this is kind of the rationale for the anti-Trumpers who have become, I don't know if you can come up with something better than this, but are they anti-pro-Cheney now? But you have Dan McLaughlin, you know, the baseball crank at National Review. If she can't move off this topic, as Mitch McConnell has, she needs to do that from the back benches, which is, okay, this may be a threat to democracy. The president is lying. He continues to lie. It's a litmus test. But you need to not talk about this so much, which is ironic because Donald Trump's still sitting down there in Mar-a-Lago, and it's the only thing he talks about. He talks about it freaking all the time. And so, speaking of cognitive dissonance.
I'm very familiar with this because I've been through this a number of times as being the guy who insists on saying, well, no, actually, you know, this thing really happened. And this is the truth. And, you know, when you get a movement or organization I'm not going to go into the details of my history of this, but we get a movement or organization that really wants to coalesce around a new party line. And there's the one guy out there saying, politely saying every time, here's the problem with that. That guy becomes the problem. And he doesn't become the problem because he's obsessed with it and he won't stop mentioning it. He becomes the problem because he's gumming up the process of coalescing around the new party line. And,
exactly.
But this is politics. This is, politics is about, we have a party and you have to go along with the party. And we always want to sort of try to force people to coalesce around whatever the new message is right now. I said, I almost feel bad about criticizing politicians for not having courage, because it's like the job description. And the other thing is, criticizing politicians for groupthink and for clustering together into protective little enclaves where everybody's supposed to think alike. That happens a lot in politics. So, but like I said, the problem is that when it becomes that sort of cloistered groupthink, you are not looking out at what does the independent voter want to hear? What does he, what does he need? And what does the country need? You're not focused on anything, but you get into this little doom spiral where you're focused on everything going on in your little clique and your organization and your party. And how are we all, cohering together around the right message, which changes every couple of weeks.
You're right about that. And, this is one of the other questions, what is actually going on with Kevin McCarthy? Okay. I mean, the guy is venal. He's spineless. He's not very bright. I get all that. You do kind of wonder whether there's some other pressure on him right now that he feels the need to do this, because one of his arguments is that she's a distraction, that, we want to be talking about policy and instead we're talking about this. Wait, by doing this, you have made this distraction times 100. This is the only thing anybody is talking about right now. People are not talking about the trillions of dollars of spending that Joe Biden is. I mean, think about the alternative reality. You have Joe Biden proposing all of these spending programs and everything. This should be in the wheelhouse of Republicans to be talking about the spending, the debt, or pretend to care about that stuff now. And instead, what are they all talking about? How we need to throw Liz Cheney under the bus. See, I think her real crime is not that she's a distraction. I mean, her real crime is that she's embarrassed these guys. And she's going to continue to embarrass these guys. And this is what I wrote today. I said, her courage highlights their cowardice. Her insistence on telling the truth underscores how corrupted they've become. And as long as she keeps doing that, as you point out, they can't move on. And so, let's throw her out. But by throwing her out, they make her bigger than ever, right? Isn't it like that Star Wars thing? You strike me down and I come back more powerful than ever, right? I mean, she doesn't go away when they vote her out.
Right, exactly. Yeah. They're raising the profile of this issue. They're raising her profile. They're doing her a favor. But like I said, it's a doom spiral where you're focused on how do you maintain the groupthink, and you're not focused on, and you can't look outside into the real world, because you're so focused on the internal dynamics within the movement and within the party.
Yeah, no, you're right. So going back to this, the point about that her big sin is that she won't shut up about this, and another one of the anti-Trumpers out there is our old friend Byron York, who's saying that, Cheney is not looking to persuade, but to bludgeon, because she keeps talking about this. Rhetorical devices like putting the big lie in all caps gave the tweet the feeling of something you might hear on CNN or MSNBC, Byron York explains. Oh, really? So interesting. It's like as if Trump doesn't exist and doesn't put things in all caps. But I, again, think about the other folks that continue to talk about this, which brings me to Josh Hawley, who still thinks that he can run for president based on, not in spite of, but maybe based on the role that he played in the January 6th insurrection. So I have two clips here. He was doing a Washington Post live thing yesterday, and he's asked about, the whole fist bump on January 6th. You can tell Josh Hawley has no problem talking about it. He's not moved on from this. He's doubling down. Here's Josh Hawley.
But when I walked by, that particular group of folks were standing there peacefully behind police barricades, well off of the plaza. And I waved to him, gave him the thumbs up, pumped my fist to him, and thanked him for being there. And they had every right to do that.
Yes. After what happened, do you regret that at all?
No, because I don't know which of those protesters, if any of them, those demonstrators, participated in the criminal riot. And I think it's a slur on the thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people who came to the Capitol that day to demonstrate peacefully, to lump them in with the criminal rioters and say, oh, you're all basically the same. It's all just the same thing.
So he's not moving off the topic, is he?
Well, at least he's saying criminal rioters, which is, you know, better than a lot of other people are doing, where they deny that anything really happened at the Capitol to begin with.
But he's basically kind of retconning it, though. It's like, it's not the stop the steal. It's just there are these this discrete group of bad people, and none of the rest of us who engaged in the big lie, who continued to undermine the legitimacy of this election, have any responsibility at all, because we're just good, happy patriots. And just
he's ignoring why the people were there in D.C. that day, which was to protest against a free and fair election and to back a conspiracy theory to back the big lie conspiracy theory. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And here's my favorite clip. You can't really hear it all, but I just want to play this, because here's Josh Hawley, graduate of Yale Law School, going back to his mantra. And again, he's being questioned on this Zoom call thing from the Washington Post Live, where he'd gone, I don't know how long it was, I'm just, you know, maybe an hour or hour and a half or whatever, where he's talking about it. And he goes back to his favorite meme. Let's play that.
Don't try to censor, cancel, and silence me here. You raise the issue. So if you raise the issue, you've got to listen to the truth. And the truth is...
She goes, Senator, we're hosting you here. He's like, you can't censor and silence me. Senator, we're hosting you here.
Yeah, it reminds me that somebody did a parody about this, I think it was Lisa Kudrow or something like that, did a parody of
fantastic,
my own.
Yeah.
Buy my book, I am being silenced, you know, go to my show, I am being silenced. And, you know, he's on the media all the time and complaining about how silenced he is. It's that shtick. But look, there's a reason he does this, which is that, and I think this is something worth looking at, that the one popular issue Republicans still have. So I think their big problem is they're looking internally in their own caucus and how you have to have loyalty to Donald Trump and loyalty to these various litmus tests, and they're not looking out to the world. But if you looked out to the broader world, the one thing you would find as like the one real popular issue Republicans have left is cancel culture. You know, people hate political correctness and independents hate it. A bunch of Democrats don't like it very much. You know, that's the thing when the left gets into its little doom spiral, where it's all about kowtowing to a little tiny minority of the base and all the litmus tests they throw up. That's when they're kowtowing to cancel culture. It's incredibly unpopular outside of there. So, you know, politicians have this antenna. They look up, they have their antenna up. And then it's, oh, people hate this, so let me try to jump on that bandwagon. And the way you jump on the bandwagon is by describing literally anything that you want to promote as being an example of that thing that people, you know, that issue that's popular. So everything's going to be cancel culture now. Yeah.
Well, it's also a way of playing the victim card, which gives you moral standing and then allows you to deflect any criticism of your behavior. So if you say something that's outrageous or irresponsible or untrue, any criticism can be, can be described as cancel culture. No, holding you accountable for the things you say and the things you do is accountability. But you know, there's a long tradition of people saying, I am a victim. The other thing that he does that's very, I actually think it has been effective, and you've seen it on the right, is to say that they're not attacking me. They're coming for you. And this is why you need me to defend you. And that has just been internalized on the right to an extent that I find really remarkable, that they basically will say that, you know, the worse they behave, the stronger their defense is, and then they try to deflect it to say, these people hate you. Have you noticed how often that narrative is out there on social media now? That mm-hmm, the left mm-hmm. doesn't just disagree with you. They hate you. They want to destroy you, which if you wonder why people are so angry and fearful and divided, that kind of rhetoric feeds into that.
Well, you know, and the thing is, I think there is something to it. Like I said, cancel culture is very unpopular. There is a wing of the left that has this very censorious attitude of, you know, your very existence offends me, and I'm going to create this endless series of litmus tests of how of what words you use and what phrases you use, and jump on you if you say something on social media. You put one word wrong, we're going to jump on you, and it is kind of random, even who do they attack and who they don't attack. So there, you know, that's a real thing that's out there. So it's, you know, it's sort of, you know, this is a common thing in politics too. It's like you find the worst people on the other side, and you,
right,
who are legitimately bad. They're really terrible people, and you take them and you say, okay, everything I'm doing is I am the answer to, I am the only answer to that, and you know it's what they would naturally do. But I think it also feeds into. We're talking about this sort of doom spiral where they're focused internally on this sort of, you know, shrinking core of hardcore people who are pro-Trump and not reaching out to the broader electorate. Well, I think the flip side of that sort of shrinking yourself down into your core is that then you become increasingly feeling beleaguered. I mean, you think of it like a cult, right? Like David Koresh and the Branch Davidians, is that the more you become this cult where everybody's gathered around the leader and has to believe these specific things, and the more restrictive it becomes, the more it also feeds into the idea that we, this small, tiny, beleaguered group, are hated by everybody else, by the rest of the world, that we're in an antagonistic relationship with the rest of the world. And that, you know, those two things sort of go together, and it's part of the doom spiral, right? Where the more you gather together into this little group, the more you feel antagonistic to the rest of the world. So the more you get, the tighter you go, and become even more antagonistic to the rest of the world. And it's a vicious cycle that's hard to get out of.
I think this may relate to this a little bit, and although it may sound like a digression. So I wrote a piece for Politico magazine, which I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the podcast today, an open letter to Paul Ryan saying this would be a good time for you to use your position on the Fox board to stand up for the things that you say you're standing up for. This is not a First Amendment issue. I want to make it clear. It's not cancel culture. This is a private company exercising editorial discretion. And, you know, so much of so much of what's happening in American politics that you specifically have spoken out against, the tribalization, the dishonesty, the poisoning of our democracy, et cetera, is coming from a company that you preside over. I think it's probably naive to think that Ryan is going to speak out. I'm really not under any illusions. On the other hand, yeah, if you're ever going to step up and change your legacy, this would seem to be the moment right now. If not now, when? But I'm getting some of the response that I'm also getting to my defense of Liz Cheney. I wrote a piece saying, you know, that Liz Cheney is really a profile in courage. I don't agree with her and everything, but I admire her guts. And there's a strain of thought out there, and you, I saw that you tweeted about it earlier today, which is from the left, which is I don't feel sorry for Liz Cheney because she built this, and therefore they're deaf to any appeal to conservatives to stand up. See, my position is at a moment like this, if somebody is willing to stand up for truth, they need to be supported and applauded. But there's a class of thought out there that all people on the right are so evil, are so corrupt, have failed so much that we just don't need them. And I think that you want to speak of a doom spiral to basically condemn everyone. And so that to the extent that there are these anti-Trumpist voices or potential anti-Trumpist voices out there, it's like, yeah, we don't want to hear from you because you guys have always been racist. You've always been bigoted. You've always been corrupt. So we don't need Romney. We don't need Ryan. We don't need any of you guys. We don't need McCain. We don't need Bush, and we don't need Cheney. You've seen that, right?
Oh yeah, and what you have to, and they do it to Bush, they do it to Bill Kristol, Bill Kristol, you built this. I'm like, really? Did he build Trumpism? I don't think so. But you have to understand that half the purpose or a large part of the purpose of Twitter is for people to feel superior to somebody else, right? Yeah. So, and I've seen this with a bunch of other issues that if you. You know, if you come to accept the truth after the other person did, that makes you like even worse in their minds, because you know, when, if you, if somebody else believes something is true and then you come to believe it's true also, that raises you to a position of equality with them, right? And the purpose of Twitter is not for us to be on a position of equality. The purpose of Twitter is for me to be morally superior and intellectually superior to you, the other person whose job is to be the target of my barbs and show how superior I am. So there's that sort of whole social media posturing sort of aspect to it that's going on. You know, we can't possibly admit that somebody on the other side who we've designated as a bad guy has done something good, because that might puncture our illusion of complete moral superiority. But the other aspect of it is that how, in terms of how you got Trump, how do you get Trump? A big part of the story is crying wolf, right? So if Mitt Romney is a sexist and a racist and a big rich guy who doesn't care about the average person and, you know, has contempt for the poor, if that's your view of Mitt Romney, right, eventually, if you keep saying that sort of thing over and over again with Mitt Romney, with George W. Bush, with everybody else, people tune you out and stop listening to you. And then a guy comes along who actually is a sexist, who actually is a is racist, who actually is a pompous rich guy who has contempt for the poor. All the things you've been saying all along, he comes along and people won't listen to you because you've cried wolf too many times. So this is sort of their fallback from the crying wolf thing of saying, well, no, maybe Mitt Romney wasn't a wolf, but he made the wolf possible. Right, so this is their way of wriggling out of the fact that they had of their own role in making this possible, in crying wolf against people who were, you know, disagreed with them about politics, but were had some level of basic decency.
So, Robert, I'm going to get huge blowback about what you just said there. And people say, "Oh, you know, that's not true." And so I just want to pause here and underline for the listeners of this podcast that I could not agree with you more on this, because I lived through this, and I've tried to make this point that if for years and years and years, every Republican, every conservative is a racist, a sexist, a xenophobe, a fascist, if supporting school choice makes you a fascist, if supporting lower taxes makes you a fascist and a racist, if, again, all of the Bushes were racist, if you said that about McCain, if you said that about Romney, at a certain point, people shrug their shoulders and they roll their eyes and they say, yeah, you know what? You know, whatever, because it's lost any power. And then when the real thing comes along and you go, wait, this guy is a racist, he's a sexist, and he's a fascist, the real thing, people go, yeah, we've heard that. And so that was one of the big problems for those of us on the right who saw that Donald Trump was, in fact, a real danger, is that all of the language had been used and conservatives have been prepped to go, I'm not going to take any of that seriously. There's another uglier part of that as well, which is that if people are called racist, you know, for a variety of things, all the time, at a certain point, not only they become numb, but they go, okay, you know, and I don't care. And maybe I should become a racist. You know what I'm saying there? I mean, you know, one right. of the things that's amazing to me has been the willingness of people on the right, and I'm not just talking about the Tucker Carlsons of the world, who are now embracing the rawest racial narratives. And it's like, wow, don't you understand how ugly this is? But it's the same sort of thing. There's been the numbs. They, okay, well, you said that when I supported this. So now that I'm playing around with replacement theory or engaging in that sort of thing, or saying that immigrants should go back to their own country and everything, you know, I'm being accused of something that, frankly, I've been accused of for the last 20 years. So maybe it's no big deal. Why not?
Yeah, and I view that as and I think you'd view it as well, as a failure of character, because obviously you shouldn't allow your views to be dictated by what other people say, right? Correct. By just being against, you know, doing it reactively and saying, because you said this mean thing to me, therefore I'm going to go ahead and embrace this. You should set your own standards and stick to those. And, you know, rejecting racist theories is a pretty clear and straightforward standard. And by the way, the great replacement thing is really a particularly nasty theory. You'll hear it. So if, for people who don't know this, the white replacement theory is the idea that The elites are deliberately bringing in black and brown people from across the world as immigrants in order to replace the white people as the citizens of the United States. Now, what they're actually – and their big sort of thing that they're upset about is the, I think the Immigration Act of 1965. Well, what that actually did is that prior to 1965, under, you know, during the era of Jim Crow, the immigration laws were overtly racist in terms of, you know, putting restrictions on immigration by non-white people. So what they're basically saying, and part of the dismantling of Jim Crow and segregation was the idea that, okay, we're going to, you know, even out the quotas and make, you know, raise some of the caps that were meant to prevent non-white people from immigrating. So what they're really complaining about is they're complaining about the dismantling of Jim Crow, or at least, you know, one small part of it. So it is a really reprehensible theory, but, you know, it goes to the fact that we have these politics that's defined so tribally on both sides, right? So the people, you know, on the left, there are people who refuse to admit that any Republican could ever do something good, unless he's dead. You know, there's an old, you know, the old trick of the only good Republican is a dead Republican, that once, you know, Ronald Reagan dies, then they can say good things about him after having defamed him for four decades. But, you know, everybody on the right must be bad, and the left and the right has this idea of, you know, I'm going to define myself by owning the libs and anything, therefore I'm against.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we've become. So let's talk about the Facebook thing. I know there's a little bit of confusion on all this. I don't know whether we'll agree on this or not. I'm actually not sure I'm going to agree with myself on all of this. But it is important to understand that there was no final decision here. It was actually kind of a punt that they made by saying that, you know, Facebook's going to have to – they're going to have to go back, you know, and come up with some sort of a standard. But they did say the ban's not permanent, and but they did make the point that it, you know, they're not going to reinstate Trump because he was putting out misinformation that may incite violence. So first of all, I mean, what's your gut sense about whether or not? Well, I mean, where do you come down on a private company like Facebook banning the president of the United States?
Oh, I'm totally in favor of the idea that a private company can ban somebody who is the most powerful and prominent political figure in the country. I love that idea. Okay, so I want to just come up with, you know, regardless of the merits of why they're doing it, I just love the idea that the CEO of Twitter or the CEO of Facebook can go to the president of the United States and say, no, you're not on our platform. We hate you. Go away. I love the fact that they can tell him basically to get lost. And that's America, man. That's what the First Amendment is all about. You know, we are people who, you know, anybody on the street, you know, the guy driving a cab can give the president of the United States a piece of his mind. That's what this country is about. So I am totally in favor of the idea that a private company, and they say, oh, well, it's a powerful private company. Yeah, but, you know, you don't have to spend – Facebook is this tiny part of the world. You know, it's a giant company, but in the scheme of things, it is not the only thing going on. There's lots of other places. Like you said, Trump now has his own little blog that he can use to communicate to his people. So the idea that private companies can tell the president get lost is great. I also think they have an excellent point that I personally am grateful for the fact that I don't have to, you know, wake up every morning and find out, you know, what mayhem did the president or ex-president create, you know, this morning because he was up at 3 a.m. and got angry at somebody and typed in all caps. I'm hugely personally grateful. I know as somebody who covers politics, I'm personally grateful that this is not part of my day anymore. So I think that, you know, and then finally, of course, you know, the January 6th did radicalize me on this, which is that he did something so unforgivable and so dangerous to the foundations of our whole political system that it is kind of like it's an unforgivable sin, right? And so he should be in exile for the rest of his life. That's my view, because he did something that is such a foundational basic attack on our political system and on representative government. The idea of not just saying the big lie that the election was stolen and the vote was rigged when it wasn't, when he didn't have the evidence for it, but also then saying, and we're going to send a, you know, encourage a mob to come to DC and intimidate Congress when it's in the process of certifying that vote. That is a fundamental attack on our whole system. So I think he deserves a lifetime ban. It's one of those. I think of the Greek. Yeah, I'm a classicist, former classicist. So I think of the Greek ostracism, right? The original meaning of ostracism is we all hold a vote and say this guy is so dangerous to our political system. He's such a power seeking demagogue. We're going to literally, you know, banish him from Athens for 10 years, and you know, and he can't come back. I think we have to do something similar here.
You know, that's interesting you say that you were radicalized by January 6th because you were pretty radical to begin with, right? I mean, but no, I wonder as I'm thinking it through and as you're describing what happened, why more people were not radicalized by it. And I think that's part of the stress of watching this, that you have half the country looked at it and saw how you described it. And do recognize why the appropriate response to that is absolute ostracism, holding everybody accountable, and then watching the Republican Party deciding that no, the one person that has refused to whitewash this is going to be thrown out. And by the way, since we started talking, I guess Steve Scalise came out and said that she needs to be thrown out of office and replaced with Lee Stefanik. So, but back to Facebook. Our colleague Amanda Carpenter tweeted out a little while ago an interesting proposal. She said, look, here's my proposal for Facebook. Tell Trump that if he officially concedes the 2020 election, states that Joe Biden won fair and square, and there was no widespread election fraud, then, okay, maybe we will think about letting you back. Until then, there is nothing to discuss. I think that I co-sign that. I think that's good.
So this is what I mean by me being radicalized, which is that prior to January 6th, I would have said, yeah, that sounds like a really reasonable proposal. After January 6th, I'm like, no, because, you know, the thing is, was it you knew damn well I was a snake, right? That's his own words against him. Yeah, this is who he is. This is so deeply revealed as his character that, you know, even if he mouths the words now, OK, I will go give this statement that you want me to give. He's going to go back and do the same thing again.
You know what? Right. You know what? You're right. You're right. I like her proposal, but you've gone to the heart of this. Is it doesn't matter what Donald Trump says tomorrow or the next day. What matters is who he is. And there's no longer any question about that. I mean, you know, he's told us who he is. He has been the snake from the beginning. And so no words, no promises are going to change that. The guy just needs to be gone and stay gone. No, I guess maybe I've been radicalized then.
I think we've all had somebody in our lives like this, right? Where you give them the benefit of the doubt and then, you know, they apologize and, you know, and if God forbid some people listening may have been in an abusive relationship, which this is very much like, where, you know, the tearful apology and I won't do it again. And of course, this is the person who's going to do it again. And at some point you just have to say, no, you are a toxic presence in my life.
So I see. I really like this analogy that in order to understand what's going on with the Republican Party, using this analogy of being in the abusive relationship will, you know, works over and over again, right? It's that, mm-hmm. you know, whatever happens, whatever apologies, whatever promises, it won't happen again. It will happen again. They've told us who they are. And again, I do think that the whole approach to Liz Cheney, which is like, you're making us do this. If you hadn't been mouthing off like that, I wouldn't have to smack you out of leadership. It really does. Works.
And even I would throw in even people like Lindsey Graham or Kevin McCarthy briefly having this moment of, OK, I'm going to leave him and then coming back. Right.
I can't quit you.
Well, there is that sort of like, you know, after a particularly abusive episode, the person who's in this sort of weird codependent relationship, this dysfunctional relationship, you know, they say, oh, I'm going to leave now. And then they're back with the guy, you know, a month later. And it's one of the sort of sick things that happens in these dysfunctional relationships. So, yeah, it is very much battered woman syndrome applied to a party.
Yeah, I've used the Stockholm syndrome analogy, but I think that that's true as well. And it's also the syndrome that, you know, when daddy comes home, that one night when daddy comes home and he's not drunk and he doesn't slap mom around, it's always fantastic. This is great. This is just, things are going to be fine now, that one night. So did you see the picture, speaking of which, that the picture that the Ted Cruz posted of himself down having dinner with Mar-a-Lago? In case your cringes have not yet cringed this morning. And a couple of things is the fact that, okay, it's an embarrassing picture. We remember the embarrassing picture of Mitt Romney and Trump. But what's interesting about the Cruz picture is not only is it humiliating in his willingness to debase himself, but he was the one that posted it. It's like, I'm going to degrade myself and then I'm going to put my degradation on social media because my degradation and my debasement is not complete until I brag about it. I mean, this is Ted freaking Cruz. And it's the abusive relationship analogy.
In that famous picture of Romney having dinner with Trump, he at least looked embarrassed. Yeah. He had this look on his face like, oh, God, you're not taking a picture of this, are you?
Yes. Why am I here? We've all had that bad moment where we've gone out on the bad date, or we've gotten together with the wrong person, or you agreed to a meeting
with somebody you really didn't want to have a meeting with, and now you're realizing that, oh, they're going to use this against me. God, you know what? Why did I do this? Yeah, that was how Romney looked in that photo.
No, actually, okay, this reminds me of a dinner I had with a guy. And I sat down and I said, okay, you know what? Before we just start, I think this is a good chance to say, you know, let's let bygones be bygones. Let's start fresh here. And the fact that, you know, and the letter that you wrote, blah, 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 about me or whatever, complaining, you know, I'm just, you know, let's just forget it. Okay. And so, right. It was going to be okay. And then we hadn't even started, you know, eating yet. And he says, what letter? I never wrote any letter. And I said, okay. I'm willing to let this go, but you wrote this letter and I've seen the letter. No. I never wrote it. It never happened. And then I realized I'm going to have to sit here and have dinner with this guy and he's looking right at me and he's just lying straight at me. And it's like, how long is this going to be? And it felt forever. In fact, I still feel like I'm at that dinner, you know? We all, and I'm not, thank God I didn't have to post that to social media. Robert Trzynski, thank you so much for joining me today and going over all of this stuff on an interesting moment in the abusive relationship known as the GOP.
Oh, I would say it's my pleasure, but it's not a very pleasant subject to discuss, but it's always fun chatting with you, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.